Okay, I guess we can start. Our speaker today is Stefan Gielen, who's going to speak about cosmology with group field theory condensates.
Okay, thank you very much. Can everybody hear me well?
Yes.
Good. Okay, so thanks for the opportunity to talk in this RQGS. It's obviously the first time for me. I think some people in the audience have seen talks on this subject before. So there may be some repetition of things that people are familiar with, but I think I just want to give a general overview here, and so there should be some new aspects on this program for everybody. And of course, whenever something is not clear, please interrupt and ask. So it's basically an overview of this program that we've started to develop over the last 2 years or so, which is addressing the old and kind of long-standing problem of describing the cosmological sector of loop quantum gravity, so to describe something that looks like a macroscopic and almost homogeneous universe, like the one we seem to live in, and to describe that kind of universe in loop quantum gravity, and to connect to the usual mini superspace descriptions that we're all familiar with. And the idea is in the title, which is that the way to describe such universes is as a kind of condensate of many quanta of geometry, and the setting we're working in is group field theory. So this is an approach that I've mainly developed with Daniele and Lorenzo, who are at the AEI in Potsdam, and there's also some work in progress with Mary Sakalariadu and two students at King's College in London. And I should also acknowledge my European Union support. So slide one is basically just a summary of the papers that we have put out on this subject so far. So the first two papers are really just the introduction of the program, the first main results that we had in the short paper, and there's a long paper in J-HEP with all the details and some background, also on the conceptual side. And the PDF has all the links to the archive versions if you're interested in looking up any of these papers with all the details. And the follow-up papers are concerned with various, in particular, physical aspects of the connection of this kind of condensate formalism in GFT to quantum cosmology. And the last one, the most recent one that came out in January by Daniele and others, is on the generalization of the kind of condensate states that we have been using. So I'll mention towards the end what this generalization could be. And there's another paper, which is in gray, where we kind of developed, so this is with Gianluca and Daniele, where we developed some of the ideas that are useful now in this GFT setting. But this was basically more of a toy model, starting from LQC, and adding some interaction term in a field theory picture, but some of the ideas that we're using now already in that paper, so that is also relevant to some extent. So slide two is the outline of my talk. There are basically five parts. I'll start with an extended introduction and motivation for the kind of approach we are taking here. Then, since I assume not everybody is really fully familiar with the group field theory a language, and in particular the kind of Fock space picture that we are using in the construction of our states, I'll say a few more words on that in the second part. Then there's this idea of a condensate in quantum gravity and in group field theory in particular, so I have to introduce that in some more detail in the third part. And then the claim is that by using these condensates, you can extract some effective quantum cosmology model from the fundamental dynamics of your theory that's given by the GFT action, basically. So that's the fourth part, and I'll show you in some more detail how we do that and what kind of phenomenology we have obtained in the cosmological interpretation of these states. And then I will summarize and have a short outlook. So slide three is just a very general introductory slide. So most of us are working on various aspects of theories of quantum gravity, But of course, at some point, we also want to connect to observation. And I hope that most people would agree that the most natural point of contact between the theories that we are studying and observational phenomena is in the cosmology of the very early universe, because there we can really expect Planckian physics or close to Planckian physics to play a role and to give us some kind of physical predictions that we then compare with observation. So then there's a challenge, which I think I would say consists of two parts. So the first part is if you believe the Copernican principle, so you think that our universe is very close to being exactly homogeneous and isotropic, then you should be able to describe such a universe in your theory that has to be time dependent, right? So we know that the universe has evolved and expanded over many orders of magnitude in its history, and so you have to be able to describe that in your theory. Basically, this is basically the kinematical side. And the second part is, of course, the dynamics, which means that if you have such a description, then you should be able to compute some effective dynamics, which you can then compare with, for example, classical general relativity with inflation. Or, of course, you can compare with any other cosmological scenario that may include a different theory of gravity or some other matter fields and so on. And then the point is that at least at late times in the evolution of the universe, when curvature is low, you would expect that this dynamical description is very similar to what you have in classical or in semi-classical general relativity. There's a slight caveat here. I just want to mention the case of black hole physics, where there was this firewall debate, which kind of seems to indicate that you may have something like a large deviation from semi-classical physics, even in a region where you think the curvature was very low and you could trust semi-classical physics. So it's not clear that this kind of naive kind of dimensional argument is always correct. But anyway, in any case, you have to be consistent with the standard cosmological models. But of course, at very early times, you would expect and you would actually want a large deviation from the classical theory in your quantum gravity description. So slide four, just a comparison with what has been done so far. I think it's fair to say that if you have, this is true pretty much in any approach in quantum gravity that I know of, if you want to describe a time-dependent space-time, this is actually quite difficult. I think this is also true in string theory, for example. So what people have done historically, the first approach, starting with Misner and Wheeler, DeWitt, and others, is the mini-superspace idea, where you do a symmetry reduction at the classical level. So you assume that you're in a homogeneous and perhaps an anisotropic metric, and that leaves you with only a finite number of degrees of freedom, which you then quantize, and you write down something like a wave function of the universe, and you see what you get. And then the most basic expectation you might have is that you can resolve the classical Big Bang singularity, but this is in fact generally not the case. So this approach remains incomplete, basically. But what you can do, and what has been done since Halliwell and Hawking and others, is to work on some kind of semi-classical background and put perturbations in homogeneities on top of that background and quantize that. And this is a very successful approach. So then what was done in loop quantum cosmology was to stay basically within the mini superspace picture, but basically improve the quantization of the FRW background by using techniques from loop quantum gravity. And as most of you, or maybe all of you know, then you have a big bounce that actually replaces the singularity. So that singularity is resolved. And then more recently, that program has been extended also to inhomogeneities, which again you treat perturbatively. So here we want to do something slightly different. So we have a Hilbert space of group field theory, or GFT, which is basically our tentative framework for quantum gravity. And in this very, very large Hilbert space, we want to identify states that we call condensate states that describe homogeneous universes. So they can be FRW, which would be the case of isotropy, or they can be one of the Bianchi models. And then once we've identified those states, we want to derive an effective quantum cosmology description from the full dynamics of the GFT when it's applied to these or restricted to these states. So slide five, there's a little diagram that explains what we're doing more pictorially. So what you may be used to, and in fact this is the traditional approach, is basically to go down the right-hand side of that diagram. So you start with your favorite classical theory. So for example, GR plus a scalar field with some potential. Then you make an ansatz for the metric and the matter field, which is basically that you're close to homogeneity. Then you end up with dynamical equations for the remaining degrees of freedom, which I call classical cosmological dynamics, which is basically usually in GR would be the Friedmann equation for the background, and then some equations for the perturbations. So this is the classical, and then you have some quantization prescription, and you end up with a quantum cosmology model. So mini superspace model, if you're just considering the background, and then some quantum dynamics also for the perturbations, and you have something that's this function psi here that depends on the scale factor and the scalar field and maybe the perturbations and some Hamiltonian constraint, and you get some form of Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Now what we are doing is basically on the left-hand side, so we have a quantum theory, which is GFT, which is a proposal for quantum gravity, and then we make an ansatz, again, for the state that we're in, inside the Hilbert space of the GFT, and the interpretation of that state would be analogous to what we did on the right-hand side in the classical case. So then we have the state, which will depend on some free parameters, or usually on a free function, which is again called psi here. And then you derive dynamical equations for the state, so for this function psi, that would basically encode the dynamics of the GFT when it's restricted to this choice of state or to this class of states. And the way we do that usually is by using the Schwinger-Dyson equations of the GFT. And then these are still very complicated, so then you need to invoke some approximations and you end up with an effective quantum cosmology description, which is again basically just the differential equation for this function psi, which here depends on GI, which are the arguments of the GFT. I'll explain that in more detail in a moment. But here I just want to show the kind of the formal analogy with the usual quantum cosmology description, with the caveat that our equations are typically nonlinear. So this is just very schematic here, you get a nonlinear equation. But now the point is that you can then compare these two descriptions on both sides, which were obtained by very different means. And that's basically the program. So slide six.
Can I ask a question at this stage quickly? So in the left-hand side, the thing that you are doing, in the full quantum theory, all the equations presumably are linear. Is that correct? On the left-hand side, in your program, at a fundamental level, the equations on the wave function are all linear equations on the wave function, right?
Well, they're linear on the Hilbert space. But the state might depend.
So they're linear on the Hilbert space. Then at the end, you obtain some equations, as you emphasize, which has nonlinearities. So are these meant to be nonlinear equations by Hilbert space, or you mean by nonlinearity something else?
They're nonlinear as functions, as equations on the function psi. I'll come to that in a second. Maybe that's clearer. So psi is a function. It's basically a set of parameters that determines the state. And so even if you had an equation that was linear on the Hilbert space, you might end up with something that's nonlinear when you express it in terms of the parameters.
Okay, we'll see when you come. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so slide six. Just a few more words on the formalism that we work in is group field theory. which is a kind of, which you can think of as a second quantized definition of the kinematics and the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. And in particular for the dynamics, if you define the dynamics of LQG through spin form amplitude, you can define that as the Feynman amplitude of the GFT. And so that's, you can think of it at that point just as a reformulation of LQG, but I think there's a clear advantage of doing that, which is that you now have a standard quantum field theory language, which gives you access to many tools and intuition from other areas of physics where quantum field theory plays a role. And in particular, what we're using here is a type of coherent state of the GFT field, or generalized coherent state. And these states are very similar to states that you use in the physics of Bose-Einstein condensates. And you can think of these states as basically our proposal for approximating some kind of continuum and non-degenerate phase of loop quantum gravity in this GFT setting. Now, there's various types of states that you can look at, and the ones that we use, at least in the simplest approximation, describe something that you can think of as some kind of gas of weakly interacting atoms or molecules of the GFT. All these terms here are, of course, in inverted commas, and there will be some other terms later on in inverted commas. What that means, of course, is that this is just all an analogy with condensed matter physics, and it may help you to get some intuition, but of course we're working in a completely different setting here, which is GFT. then the point is that a continuum space, and in fact space-time, emerges in the hydrodynamic approximation of this condensate, so as a kind of quantum fluid that is fundamentally made up of discrete quanta, but can be described at some effective level as a continuum. And just from the LQG point of view, I should say already at this point that these states involve a kind of superposition of an infinite number of graphs. Slide 7. So this ends the...
Can I ask a question at this point?
Sure.
So you said that the coherent states that you are considering can be seen as the analog of a weakly interacting molecules. But do I understand correctly that you don't have any interaction terms? So in a certain sense, those atom of space are completely disconnected?
That's right. So I'll come to that in a moment. It's true that in the simplest approximation, you basically have a bunch of these atoms which are disconnected. So in a way, one way of interpreting that is that this is one way of implementing exact homogeneity, right? If you have an exactly homogeneous geometry, then there's basically no spatial gradients, and so you can think of the points in some sense as disconnected. I mean, this is just an intuitive picture. Again, this is just the simplest approximation. I'll mention later on that you can do something more refined. But it's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Question, related question.
Okay.
Usually when we use condensates in condensed matter physics, we do it in order to construct an approximate expression which minimizes the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. But there's no dynamics here that you're making use of. Is that right? You're basically just by hand inserting an ansatz which gives you homogeneous universes, because that's what you'd like to describe.
Well, so
it says that the universe that's in its ground state should be homogeneous.
I think I'll explain all of these aspects in more detail later on, but. We are making an ansatz here for the state at the kinematical level to some extent, but then we are also imposing the dynamics of GFT through the Schwinger-Dyson equations. And that will give us restrictions on the type of condensates that are allowed. Of course, it's true that there is no energy here in the sense of condensed matter physics, but there is still dynamics which is defined by the GFT action and by the usual dynamics of a quantum field theory.
Okay,
I'm not sure that answers the question.
Well, let's get to details. Thank you.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, if not, let's go to slide 8. So, group field theory, just in one sentence, if somebody asks me what group field theory is about, I can just give them the basic definition, which is that A group field theory is defined a path integral for discrete quantum gravity, and that path integral includes a sum over the topologies and the discretizations that are compatible with some given boundary geometry, which is also discrete geometry. Now, how do you define these boundary geometries? You can do that by using a Fock space picture of the GFT, and then you have boundary states, which are elements of this Fock space, and which can be labeled. There are several representations for these states, but in the group picture, you can label these states by the arguments of the GFT field. So the GFT field phi is a complex field on four copies of a Lie group G. And the elements of these four copies of G are the possible parallel transports that you can associate to four links that are dual to the faces of a tetrahedron, or equivalently, the parallel transports that you can associate to a four-valent open spin network vertex in LQG. These are just the usual dual pictures of the same data. And then there's an equation here, which is just very schematic as a definition of the dynamics of the GFT through a kind of partition function. So S is some action. And then in the usual way, you can expand this partition function in Feynman graphs. So gamma are the Feynman graphs that you sum over. Here you have one coupling, lambda. So lambda to the n comes from having n vertices in the given graph gamma. Then there's a symmetry factor in the usual way, and there's some amplitude z of gamma, which you would normally think of as the spin form amplitude associated to that graph. So then you give that definition basically by prescribing the action S, and then that gives you a tentative sum over histories for the quantum gravity, which is not defined on any fixed lattice or discretization because you sum over or the gammas. So the slogan then is that this is the quantum field theory not on space but off space. So the field does not live on any Minkowski space-time or any other background space-time, but on this auxiliary group space, and physical space then is described by the quantum excitations of this quantum field theory.
Thank you very much for this very nice introduction, Anit. And interlinking with the loop quantum gravity and spin forms. But in loop quantum gravity and spin form, there is no coupling constant lambda. So as far as this talk is concerned, are we to think of little lambda as just a mathematical parameter that has been introduced, which is to be said to be equal to 1 at the end of the day? Or are we to think of this lambda as some physical parameter? And if it is a physical parameter, what would its meaning be in quantum field in cosmology?
Right. So there is a sum over the different graphs or the different complexes, and that involves a weight that you associate on top of just having the usual prescription for the spin form amplitude, which would be the z of gamma. You also have an additional weight, which is given by lambda to the n. And you can, of course, think of lambda as equal to 1, but it could also be something else. I think, so here I'm just presenting one particular description, which basically involves generating spin form amplitudes with weights given by lambda to the n. And it's true that you may think of lambda as being fixed to a particular value, but here I'm really, I'm just keeping this in the usual GFT setting. For cosmology, I think, One advantage of our program is that it gives us some idea of the physical meaning of lambda. So we can actually, if we look at the cosmological sector, then what we get depends on the value of lambda. So we can study that in this setting.
Please go ahead.
I think Daniela wants to say something here.
Can you hear me? So I think that the best way to see this coupling constant and in general coupling constants in GFT is as a way to parameterize our choices of spin form amplitudes, meaning that when we define a spin form model, we choose some vertex amplitude. And of course, we could, in principle, introduce more vertex amplitudes, more type of interactions for our spin networks. And the coupling constants that we include in GFT are just a way to weight these different terms that we could add defining our model. And then we leave the RG flow in the first place, and then, you know, the extraction of physical quantities to tell us which one is relevant or more relevant than others at different scales in different regimes, which is, by the way, exactly what we do in standard field theory. Then you can, if you ask for the physical meaning of those, well, the answer to this question has to come from extracting the physics from the models, and there in the effective dynamics, you will be able to interpret the various constants and parameters you have in your dynamics in physical terms by comparing them with the effective gravitational dynamics. That would be at least my viewpoint.
Okay, so you're saying that there is a one parameter family of extended spin form models parameterized by this lambda. For each value of lambda, you would get different...
Yeah, no, not exactly. What I'm saying is that when we construct a spin form model, we make a set of choices. For example, one thing would be to choose for a given way of imposing constraints, say the PRL model, we choose, say, the combinatorics of our complexes. For example, we decide that we work on simplicial complexes. That is, our vertex, spin form vertex is dual to a four simplex. And you can make other choices. And this is for a given choice of interaction kernel, for a given choice of weight given by the PRL amplitude. All these choices, if you want to treat them to ask the dynamics of the theory, which one is the right one, then you weight them by a coupling constant. And then you ask the renormalization group flow of the model to tell you which one is relevant or more relevant at different scales, in different regimes. So it's a way to parameterize the choices you have to make in your model building. If you think about it, it's the same that you do in ordinary field theory. If I just tell you that you have a scalar field theory for some choice of symmetries, you can write down a phi to the 6th, phi to the 4th, phi to the 8th, and more general choice of interaction kernels. And there's no specific reason to restrict to one in particular. You want the theory to tell you which one is relevant at different scales or in different physical contexts. So you parameterize all these different, you weight all these different interaction terms by a constant, a coupling constant, and the relative value of these constants in different regimes will tell you which one is the effective dynamics in that regime. So this is the formal role that these coupling constants play in this particular field theory or in spin form models. As for the physics, again, the task is to extract some effective gravitational dynamics that you can compare with some modified version of GR. Once you've done that, and Stefan is presenting one attempt to, one strategy to try to do that, but it's only once you have done that that you can compare the role of these constants in the effective GFT dynamics with the physical coupling constants in effective GR gravitational dynamics.
Thank you. I think we should let Stefan go on. I mean, I think we're agreeing, but we can talk later.
Sure. Okay, so slide 9. That just gives some more explicit details of the Fock space. So you start, when you want to construct a Fock space, you start with a vacuum, which is here denoted by this empty set state, basically, which is the vacuum of the GFT Fock space, and analogous to the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum in LQG, it's a completely degenerate geometry where volumes and areas and so on would all be zero. And then you start with this vacuum, and you can create excitations over that vacuum by using your creation operators in the usual way. So here you have this complex field phi and the conjugate phi dagger, and phi dagger is a superposition of creation operators, and it has four arguments, as I said before, which are the elements of the group that you're working with. And then here's just a cartoon, basically, that tells you that this one particle state that you create by acting on the vacuum can be pictured as a tetrahedron, which has a vertex in the middle and four links going through the faces, and you associate these group elements to the links, and you interpret them as parallel transports of the gravitational connection, so in the same way that you do in LQG and also in lattice gauge theory. So that's one representation. There's a dual representation, which is basically the momentum representation, where you have basically a triad, so a discrete metric, which is the canonically conjugate variable. And then you can now build up the whole Fock space of tetrahedra, and in the usual LQG language, you think of the tetrahedron as dual to a four-valent vertex, and then if the group is SU2, then you can identify arbitrary four-valent spin network states with many particle states in the GFT Fock space. And there's more details in a paper by Daniele. And this defines a kinematical Hilbert space of the GFT. This is, of course, not the same Hilbert space that you have in LQG because, for example, you don't have the notion of cylindrical consistency. But it's a standard Fock space, as we are familiar with from QFD. And this is just the kinematical Hilbert space, so we have to impose dynamics. So slide 10 just explains how to impose dynamics, very schematic. You have an action for the field and the complex conjugate. And here I'm just giving a very general form of the action. So you have a quadratic part, which is determined by some what I call kinetic term K. Again, of course, it's just an analogy. And then there's a potential. And as was shown by Weisenberger and Trovelli many years ago, you can choose the GFT model such that its Feynman amplitudes equal the quantum amplitudes of a given spin form model. And then the role of the potential is to define the gluing of tetrahedra to form four-dimensional structures, which is basically the vertex amplitude in LQG, and the kinetic term gives you a kind of propagator. And for a normal spin-form model, you would just take a trivial propagator, so K would just be a delta function. But then there's another viewpoint where you study, for example, the renormalizability. So you think about renormalization of these GFT models, and then you find that you may require a non-trivial propagator that also includes derivatives on the group. And here I'm just listing a few names of people that have worked on this. And then, of course, you can also generalize the potentials. I think this is basically what Daniele has just explained in more detail. Here, I really just want to be more open to the kind of action that you may choose to have. The point is really that this program that we are following here is completely general, and it allows you the extraction of some kind of cosmological dynamics from basically any given GFT action. So whenever you you define what S is by, for example, if you want to reproduce a particular spin-form model, you can then follow this program and see what it tells you for cosmology. So that's really the point I want to make here. Slide 11. There's just a few more words on the philosophy. So basically what we are trying to do in LQG is to directly quantize general relativity. So we start with a classical theory of gravity with the variables of that theory, and we formulate a consistent quantum theory, and the dynamics comes from some version of the Einstein-Hilbert action, for example, like a constrained BF theory, and so on. And then, of course, you can do that, but what we know from other situations in physics, in quantum field theory, and also in quantum gravity, you can actually end up with a quantum theory that can have low energy properties that you did not expect from the classical theory. So something like the mass gap in QCD, or also in CDT, and in DT, of course, in particular, you had these non-geometric phases, so causal dynamical triangulations. So the point is really that we want to understand better the kind of collective behavior of a very large number of degrees of freedom in LQG. And the way we can do that using the GFT formalism is, again, as Daniele has said, using renormalization. And then you can expect to find, in the general case, depending on the coupling constants of your theory, different kind of ground states, different phases of your theory, and you may have something like a geometric phase that looks approximately smooth and four-dimensional, or something non-geometric that has very different properties. And these phases are typically described by inequivalent Hilbert spaces. So basically our approach is to study one proposal for one of these phases in terms of the condensates we are using. Slide 12 just ends the second part. So are there any more questions at this stage?
Well, I have a question.
Uh-huh.
So even before you introduced the dynamics, you were talking about things like creation annihilation operators, vacuum, and so on and so forth, that all imply a notion of a Hamiltonian somehow. Can you say a little bit more about that?
There is no direct Hamiltonian, but what we are using, so slide 9 was just introducing formally the definition of the Fock space. So it's basically on a more algebraic level, where you start with a vacuum that you just assume is you know, the ground state in some sense, or you just...
But what do you mean by that? I mean, is it annihilated by a Hamiltonian, or...?
Well, it's annihilated by phi. So you basically have an algebra of annihilation and creation operators, and the field phi is a superposition of the annihilation operators, and phi dagger is a superposition of creation operators. These commutation relations are imposed on phi and phi dagger. And then you basically have this algebra that allows you to now construct the whole Fock space starting from the vacuum. It's not derived from a Hamiltonian at this stage.
But implicit in it is a Hamiltonian, right, and a notion of time.
I'm not sure about that. You can think of the, I would say that you can think of the usual kind of ladder operators just on a purely algebraic level. I mean, you can say you start with a vacuum, and then you have an algebra of these operators, which normally, of course, is indeed derived from a Hamiltonian, but you can view it as independent of that, I think. At least that's what we're doing here.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry, I think the word vacuum and so on is being used really in completely mathematical sense, right?
That's right.
For example, at the classical level, you know, people, simplistic geometry people say any function on the phase space, and they will call it a Hamiltonian, a possible Hamiltonian, so to say. But here the statement is that you are just given algebra and you are given a positive linear function on it. And so long as that defines a state. And if the state is cyclic, that is to say, every state is generated by action of the algebra of operators on that state, that is a mathematical vacuum. And I think that is the sense in which this term is being used here, not in the sense of a Hamiltonian. So please, Stefan, are you agreeing with me?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I comment? Can I ask a question on this? I would like to ask to comment about the cylindrical consistency, because it seems to be related with the question of before. So if I understand correctly, when you create a new tetrahedron in this picture, is a completely disconnected tetrahedron. It's not like increasing the size of a given graph, but just creating a new disconnected piece. So in this sense, you don't need the cylindrical consistency. Is this correct?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So it's true that, yes, what you create is open spin networks. So you just create a new open vertex. You can glue links together if you want, starting from these open networks. But the point about cylindrical consistency is that you have a state on one graph which is equivalent to a state on a larger graph, and here that's clearly not the case. So the Fock space is just composed of subspaces at fixed number of vertices, and these are all orthogonal. So I can never identify a state with one given number of vertices with a with another state with a different number of vertices. So that's missing. So that that basically was the statement.
Since we are asking about this, are you then going to impose gauge invariance and glue this iterator one to the other in a gauge invariant manner, or are you not?
Right. So you have to ensure, of course, that the states you're looking at are gauge invariant. I'll come to that in a second. And one very natural way, in particular from the perspective of LQG, of course, is to only consider closed spin networks. So that's one thing you can do. For example, you can just create a number of, you can create a number of these tetrahedra or open vertices and then make sure that all the links are glued together in such a way that you get a closed spin network. But in general, of course, gauge invariant states, yes.
But then there is no relation in the formalism between states, once you've created a spin network state, states on a different number of, on different graphs. So with different graphs, you have different states, or you may identify states on different graphs?
No, that's what I was trying to say. So in the Fock space, basically all the subspaces that are associated to a given graph are orthogonal. So there's no way of identifying states with states on a larger graph as you would do in LQG by having this requirement of cylindrical consistency. So we don't have that here.
But in LQG, you have that requirement because state in a larger graph may have some links to j equal to 0, and there then identify the state in the smaller graph. So do you not have such states at all, or do you have such states, but they are still regarded as being orthogonal to each other?
So we have those states, but they are still orthogonal. So you can create, it depends on the states you choose, for example, for one tetrahedron, but you can create one that would just correspond to j equals 0, but it would still not be equivalent to the state where you did not create that tetrahedron.
Okay, so you have a huge kind of amplification of the Hilbert space, right? Because of not of having this identification. I mean, the Hilbert space is much, much larger than the loop quantum, infinitely larger at any stage compared to the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space.
I'm not sure how to make that mathematically precise, but so it's still a separable Fock space, of course, that we have. But it's true that in the sense you're saying, this Hilbert space is much, much larger than the space you would have in LQG because this identification of states is not there. That's true.
So
let's go again.
So for instance, you have a huge sector of this theory with a lot of tetrahedra with zero error and zero volume. You can have one of them, and they're all states in this theory.
That's correct, yes. Should I go ahead with the talk? Or?
I think so. I think we'll have questions at the end, maybe, because I would like to get to the main point, which has to do with cosmology.
Yes. Okay. So slide 13. Just a few more words about the condensate. So again, I introduced this Fock vacuum for LQG for GFT, which is in some sense corresponds to the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, so it's a completely degenerate phase. And what we are suggesting here is that there is a different phase in GFT, which is a phase away from this Fock vacuum, which can be described in a way that's very similar to what you have in condensed matter physics, where there's condensation of a large number of bosons into a common ground state. And we are trying to follow this analogy very closely here. And as you would do in the case of a real condensate, you can approximate the physical state that describes the phase by the kind of coherent state of the field operator, which is characterized by a non-zero expectation value for the field, phi, whereas the expectation value would be zero in the vacuum, in the Fock vacuum. there's a geometric interpretation that you can give to these condensate states as macroscopic homogeneous universes, which I'll make more explicit in a moment. What we do here is we still work in the same Fock space, so still in this Fock space that I introduced, and we have a very large number of quanta. For an actual phase transition, you would take the thermodynamic limit in which n goes to infinity, which you can here view as a kind of continuum limit, and then you would have to go to a different Hilbert space because these states are no longer normalizable in the original Fock space. Slide 14. So these are now some equations introducing these states. So yes, the first sentence just says again that we are thinking of some kind of condensation of GFT quanta, and we describe this with states that are similar to coherent states in Bose-Einstein condensates or also squeeze states in quantum optics. And the simplest states that we can use are of the form in the first equation. So if you remember, phi dagger is a superposition of creation operators in the way we define it. So it creates a tetrahedron. You introduce this function sigma that's called the condensate wave function in the condensed matter literature, again, all with inverted commas. So then you integrate over the common arguments and you take the exponential, and this m of sigma is just a normalization factor. And now if you expand the exponential in power, you see that you have a superposition of states with different particle numbers, and at each for each of these states at some given particle number, you have basically n identical particles, which are all determined by this, whose state is all determined by this wave function sigma. And indeed, it's not clear whether the state is now gauge invariant because it corresponds to this collection of open vertices. So you have to impose some restrictions on the wave function sigma, basically, to make the state gauge invariant. You can do something else, which is the second equation, which is automatically a gauge invariant state. So here you create two particles, so there's two creation operators, and then you introduce this this function psi here that determines the state, and because you've identified the arguments g and h, this basically describes a closed graph, which is the dipole graph, so which corresponds to two tetrahedra, where you identify the faces pairwise and you basically get a three sphere. So then you have a gas of these dipoles. And again, it's the exponential that gives you, that you can expand in powers and that gives you a superposition of all different particle numbers. Here, of course, just even particle numbers. So again, from the perspective of LQG, this is some kind of superposition of graphs, which all have different numbers of vertices. Slide 15 is just a few more words about the geometric interpretation. So what we are using in our construction to justify the interpretation of these as homogeneous geometries is an embedding into a manifold. So you start with some manifold, and you have a group action on that manifold which defines the notion of homogeneity, right? So this would just mean that the spatial metric is compatible with this group action. And that interpretation is kind of similar to the canonical LQG picture, where you think of a state as describing a geometry on some given spatial hypersurface, which here is given by this manifold M. So this is just a cartoon where you have N, some large finite number, N of tetrahedra, which you place at N points in this manifold. And you also fix a frame of left invariant vector fields that's compatible with this group action, which fixes the orientation of the tetrahedra in the embedding. And then you extract the geometric information from the state, which would tell you that the metric that you reconstruct, for example, by measuring areas and lengths and so on at some point where there's a tetrahedron, that would be consistent with a homogeneous metric because in this frame of left invariant vector fields, you get a metric that is the same at these n points. But then, of course, it's still just a finite number of points, so it doesn't look very much like a continuum. But now there's also this superposition of all different numbers of tetrahedra, and then the continuum emerges in the hydrodynamic description. In the same way that if you have, again, for the real condensate, fundamentally you have atoms or molecules, but then there's an effective description in which you can describe the condensate as a kind of fluid. And that's exactly what we want to do here. And then this approximates the continuum, and better as larger as n gets larger as possible. So slide 16, just the analogy with real condensates. So this is probably familiar to many people, but maybe not to everyone. So if you have, so this is now I'm talking about condensed matter physics on this slide. If you want to describe the physics of a real Bose-Einstein condensate, again, you have some field operator, phi, so big phi here, and phi dagger is a kind of creation operator or superposition of creation operators. Again, you introduce this function sigma, which is called the condensate wave function, and you take this exponential, which gives you a very large number of these particles. Now the question is, what does sigma actually mean? It's just some function on R3. Of course, here there's a background R3 on which these particles live. It's just standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So sigma psi is some function on R3, which actually has a very direct physical interpretation. So you can write it in the usual way. It's a complex function. You can split it into amplitude and phase. And so then you introduce these functions rho and theta. And now the point is that these functions represent basically classical fields, classical quantities, which are the density and the velocity potential of this fluid that's represented by the condensate. So velocity potential means that the gradient of theta is proportional to the velocity. So there's something very funny going on here. You started with this complicated many-particle quantum system. And now by using this ansatz for the state, for the many-particle state, you end up with a description that directly connects to basically classical hydrodynamics. And the way you see that explicitly is that you get an equation, the standard equation that controls dynamics for psi is the Gross-Peterjewski equation. And if you rewrite that in terms of the fields rho and theta, at least in the h bar to zero limit, you recover exactly the hydrodynamic equation. So there may be some quantum terms that you can't explain in terms of classical physics, but you get something that directly corresponds to the continuity equations and the Euler equations of standard hydrodynamics. So this is basically what we now want to do for GFT. So we want to get something that describes cosmology in this hydrodynamic description of this condensate that we're looking at. So slide 17. Just tells you how we do that. So you now need dynamics. You have, again, this kind of condensate wave function, which here I use xi. So this would correspond to this gas of dipoles. So it's a function on the space of group elements, on four copies of the group. And you want to get dynamical equations for xi. And one approach for getting those equations is by looking at Schwinger-Dyson equations of the GFT. So here you choose some observable, which is some functional of the field and the complex conjugate. And S, again, is the action of the GFT. And then you can basically formally derive from the path integral that these expectation values have to vanish in the state that's given by xi. And if you do this for the real condensate and O is equal to 1 or constant, you just get the second term, which basically tells you, which gives you the equation of motion coming from the action S as an expectation value. And that would just give you the Gross-Peterjewski equation. So that's the standard approximation to the full dynamics in the case of real condensate. And we're now doing something like that in the case of GFT. And by choosing more and more complicated observables, you get more and more complicated Schwinger-Dyson equations, which are all basically dynamical, which are basically all conditions on the state to be a dynamical state. There's an alternative approach to getting the dynamics, which uses this notion of fidelity. There's a paper by Lorenzo on that. And the point is now that you get some equations, differential equations for xi, which are in general nonlinear and non-local. So now you have to interpret those equations in terms of cosmology. So what's the role of this condensate wave function xi again, it's analogous to what we had before in the case of the real condensate, is a complex function on the configuration space. So here the configuration space is the space of configurations of one tetrahedron, or alternatively, since we are now working in a state which is filled with, in which you have a universe filled with identical tetrahedra, these are the possible configurations of the homogeneous universe. So that's exactly what we normally call a mini superspace, finite dimensional. And so now we have this field on a kind of effective mini superspace, which is the analog of this order parameter psi that you would have in a real condensate. Slide 18.
So you say that you're achieving homogeneity by taking all the tetrahedra being the same. But previously you said that your condensate is formed by many dipoles. So each dipole can accommodate anisotropy and inhomogeneities. So if you take just all the dipoles to be the same, then you end up with something that is anisotropic and inhomogeneous. So I suppose you have to impose some further constraints on the dipoles.
Okay, so far I never mentioned isotropy. So the condensates that we are using describe general homogeneous universes, which can be completely anisotropic. So
I said that each dipole can be inhomogeneous as well.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, in our interpretation, we have basically a large number of identical dipoles, which you can think of as embedded into this manifold, and then the metric you would reconstruct from that would look the same at each point where there's a dipole. So there's no room for inhomogeneities in this setting.
But do you agree that if a dipole is formed by two tetrahedra glued together, the two tetrahedra can have a different volume?
Well, that's true, of course. But so basically, you should think of a coarse-grained picture. I mean, we are not, the picture we are using is this hydrodynamic approximation where you are no longer able to resolve the structure within the dipole. So it's, you know, you could say the same thing about a molecule. Perhaps there are, you know, different configurations of a molecule, but you are not really looking at that anymore. You are looking at this coarse-grained picture where you just have a fluid which looks completely homogeneous. So that's the picture we have here. So the inhomogeneities that we would want to describe are certainly on much, much larger scales than the scales set by the dipole.
I think the question or comment, the problem that some of us are having is that you just say something that you'd like your theory to produce, that the inhomogeneities occur at large scales compared to the Planck scale. But there doesn't seem to be any dynamics which is enforcing that desire. You're just putting that in by hand and seeing what the result is.
I'm not sure I understand that question fully. So what we are using here is an ansatz where the universe described by our states is exactly homogeneous. That is certainly an assumption at this stage.
The question is, Valentina, somebody might prefer a different ansatz which has strong inhomogeneity. And generally when we try to extract a low energy physics, there's some principle of dynamics that tells us that the composite degrees of freedom or the homogeneous or collective degrees of freedom we're extracting do dominate at low energy.
Right. So, if I understand that question, you're asking whether the states we're using can be in some sense extended or embedded into a larger class of states that are inhomogeneous, and then we could show that somehow the homogeneous mode dominates. Is that the question?
For example, that might be one way to approach it.
Okay. So I'm not sure how to answer that at this stage. So here we are really just enforcing exact homogeneity on these states. And how to go beyond that is certainly an open question that I will address at the end, if I have time.
But Lee, it seems to me that it is exactly what one would do in condensed matter systems, right? I mean, you make an ansatz and see that there are solutions of that kind. And then a second question is, do these states dominate dynamics at some scale or some physical conditions? And they are addressing the level of the question at the first level. It could be that with that ansatz there are no solutions, in which case, you know, it is just inconsistent. But they are not, at this stage, as Stefan said, they're just accepting the Copernican principle. In other words, let's look for an ansatz. Let's look for states which satisfy our ansatz and see what dynamics they satisfy. And at the second stage, one might see if this dynamics is actually the dominant one under some physical conditions.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think this is already very non-trivial and classical GR, so it's really just an ansatz at this stage. Okay, should I go ahead?
Please go ahead.
Okay, right, so slide 18. So I told you that there is in general this large number of independent Schwinger-Dyson equations, and of course now you have to make an approximation, which is to take the simplest ones. And these are then differential equations for this wave function psi. In which sense is this a wave function? Well, it's again, you can look at the analogy with condensed matter physics, which tells you that there isn't really a wave function interpretation associated to this. There's no probability interpretation, but it's closer to something like a field on mini superspace, which encodes this hydrodynamic description of the GFT condensate. So in general, then, you have to ask yourself how to extract a physical interpretation from this field on mini superspace. And one way that we have done that so far is to use global observables. What I mean by that is something you can associate to the condensate as a whole. So you can, for example, just compute the total volume of the condensate. And this is well defined, and it involves some kind of integral over the group space, over the mini superspace. Here I'm just giving you a schematic equation for the general structure of these observables. So O can be some function on the group or can be some differential operator. And this defines an operator on the Fock space, and then you can compute the expectation value. And there are observables of this type that correspond to things like the scale factor or the Hubble parameter and so on, which have a direct analog in cosmology, or you can have things like the total particle number. So there's, of course, a number operator, and you can just compute the expectation value, and then you basically get the average number of tetrahedra in your condensate, and that obviously has no classical analog. So now we have to make sense of that for cosmology. For a real condensate, these would be things like total momentum or some global charges and so on. And you can now look at the Schwinger-Dyson equations, and these give you relations between these expectation values in the same way that you would expect from the Friedmann equation, or in general, the Hamiltonian constraint in GR just gives you a constraint basically on the, for example, in vacuum on the scale factor and the Hubble parameter in the case of isotropy. So that's now the approach, and we just see what we obtain in terms of these relations. So that's on slide 19. So in one case, in one particularly simple case, you can show that you get one of the Schwinger-Dyson equations for this wave function psi, which just becomes linear in psi, and also just depends on this kinetic operator. So it means only depends on what you had in the quadratic part of the GFT action. So again, that's just a schematic equation. Of course, this is a very, very simple approximation, which clearly doesn't capture the full dynamics of the GFT, since the potential doesn't play a role anymore. But it is a very simple approximation in which we can now go ahead and see what we get in terms of cosmology. So that's what we did. So here's just one example in which you take a kinetic part that consists of one part that contains derivatives, so in terms of this Laplace-Beltrami operator on the group, so that's what I mean by delta GI, and then there's m squared, it's just a constant, so that's basically like a mass term, and then you impose isotropy, so again, this is an additional restriction here, you assume an isotropic universe, you compute these expectation values, and you find a relation that that you see in this equation, which now plays the role of something like the Friedmann equation. So let me explain a bit more what you see here. So A is basically the scale factor that you associate to your isotropic condensate. Omega is the connection in the usual way. There's an L chunk, which comes when you compute the expectation value. Some of them have powers of L Planck. And there's N, which is the number of quanta in the condensate. And now, of course, you see that just as an LQC, we don't the connection itself is not defined as an operator, as a variable in the theory. You only have parallel transports, so you always get this type of holonomy correction. As an LQC, you just get sine of mu times omega. And then what we can actually show is that mu, which at this stage is unknown, you can show that this also scales with the number of quanta, and it goes like n to the minus 1/3. So now you have this kind of Friedmann equation, which looks a bit weird, and it has these three different terms, and it's not clear which one of these terms really dominate in a realistic cosmological situation, since they all scale with n, or the second and third scale with n, so you have to know, you have to have an idea about the number of quanta in your condensate. And so you need to put in some additional assumption, for example, at this stage, for the relation between n and the scale factor A. And this is very much similar to what was done in LQC under the name of lattice refinement. And so at this stage, what you get really depends on this relation, but you can see already from the type of holonomy corrections that if n scales with a cubed, so the number of particles is proportional to the total volume, then you recover the improved dynamics prescription, because then mu just goes like 1 over a. But of course, in general, other possibilities exist depending on the relation between n and a. Okay, so now slide 20, just a summary of our results, what we've done so far. So in general, you can follow this program. You have a particular type of condensate. You go to this hydrodynamic approximation, and then you get something like a classical Friedmann equation, which, of course, may differ strongly from what you have in classical GR, in particular depending on this relation between the number of tetrahedra and cosmological observables. So the first thing we did was to take this formal WKB limit where L Planck goes to zero. So if you go back to slide 19, you will see that then only the first term survives. So now back to slide 20. So then this first term basically just gives you the Friedmann equation for vacuum GR. And we could show that you can get this for Lorentzian or Riemannian signature, and you can also include a massless scalar field, which comes with a right coupling, naturally. And then Gianluca has also shown that in this WKB limit, you can derive the right form of LQC holonomy corrections if you use a particular matter coupling. But now, of course, since there's a scaling not only with L Planck in these terms, but also with n, you should really, in general, keep all of the terms and look at the scaling of n with the scale factor. So this now leads to a more general class of effective Friedmann equations. And in principle, of course, you should be able to compute this relation between n and a, and you can compute it if I give you a particular condensate state. But it's not so clear yet in which way this is constrained. So this is something we have to work on. We've shown that the type of holonomy corrections scale like n to the minus 1/3, and I don't really have time to explain how, but basically what you have to do is you have to distinguish between intensive and extensive observables, and that leads you to this relation. And now, of course, we can go ahead and look at the phenomenology of these models. For example, one nice idea is that you could have something like an effective cosmological constant. So one of the terms in the effective Friedmann equation could look like cosmological constant. And one crazy idea is that then if this comes with the right power of n, it might actually be very small. So you might explain the magnitude of the cosmological constant. This, of course, is just one possibility, and we have to see whether it's actually realized. You might also find higher derivative corrections to GR and all kinds of other things. And again, this all comes just from assuming a particular form of the GFT dynamics and, of course, a particular class of condensate states. You can compute all these things. So So slide 21 is basically just the outlook. We have so far focused on understanding this semi-classical limit, basically given by this Friedman equation, when the curvature is small, so you are in a region where you think you should well approximate what you know from GR. But of course, we can push this program further, and we can actually address more interesting questions eventually. So of course, one question that we always want to address is what happens to the initial singularity at the Big Bang. In our language, this would mean to ask whether the approximation of a fully dynamical state by a given condensate breaks down at some point. And this is something that you can see, again, for real condensates. You can have such a breakdown of the approximation, and that usually signals a phase transition. So here you might have a phase transition in the GFT at high curvature from some smooth four-dimensional phase to something that looks completely different. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, of course, that we have a picture that's similar to what we have in LQC, that is basically there is one description which is valid even in the Planckian regime, and which would here be given by basically the same condensate. Then the second question, of course, is a major one. If we want to talk to cosmologists, we need to go away from exact homogeneity, and we have to include some small perturbations, and these have to be localized, and there has to be a description for these as propagating on some background that is given by the homogeneous condensate. So you start with one of the states I showed you, for example, that are exactly homogeneous, and then you need to describe how inhomogeneities propagate with respect to this background. One nice idea that we would like to understand whether it has a connection to our program really is that inhomogeneities can appear as nonlinearities in quantum cosmology. So there's basically one paper by Martin Buyewald and collaborators. And here there's just basically a formal observation that our equations are naturally nonlinear, so they might encode inhomogeneities. But this is, of course, something we have to make much more precise. So slide 22 is just a summary to wrap up. I argued that you can use this idea of condensates in GFT, the condensate of a type of atoms or molecules of the GFT, and you can view it as one proposal for describing a macroscopic and spatially homogeneous non-degenerate universe in LQG using the GFT language. And in the simplest approximation that I talked about, there's just this gas of disconnected quanta, but you can actually do something better than that. You can work on a connected graph and define a similar type of condensate on the connected graph, which then includes already topological information, because the graph, of course, has a topology, and so you no longer need to assume the topology of spatial slices as we have so far in this embedding. And that's a recent paper basically by the AEI group, and there will also be an ILQGS by Lorenzo Sindoni later on this term. So then, using the GFT formalism, you can treat these states with methods that are similar to what you have in real condensates. You can derive an effective dynamics for the condensate wave function, and you can interpret that as an effective quantum cosmology model. And then in the hydrodynamic description of this condensate, you can use expectation values of the observables in GFT to get something like a generalized Friedman equation in the way I showed. Of course, there are many, many open questions. We have to make sure that this low energy description makes sense. We have to understand the stability of the approximations that we are making, and that is very strongly connected to the question of what happens to the singularity. There might be a role for phase transitions in the GFT, which we have to understand much better, of course, and we have to go away from only the isotropic homogeneous case. And then if we really want to do cosmology, of course, we also need matter fields, and we have to talk about the cosmological constant and many, many other things. So next slide is just thank you for your attention.
Questions?
I have a question from, this is Carlo, can I go ahead?
Sure.
Where does the mass M in slice 19 go into the Friedman equation?
It's in the last term, so there's an m squared there.
So it disappears in the limit in the classical limit.
Well, if you think that the right classical limit is L Planck to zero, while, for example, keeping n fixed, then that statement is true. Then it would disappear. What I was trying to explain is that this may not be the right limit to consider.
That may not be the right limit.
Yes. Well, I mean, n is the number of quanta. You want to have a limit. So, for example, So n is something that has no classical analog, right? It's the number
n,
of tetrahedra.
The mass n.
N, capital N. The number of quanta in the condensate. So that has no classical analog. So it's
why?
For me, it's physically a bit unclear whether
why?
You can just take L Planck to zero and keep n fixed.
Why the number of photons in a given coherent state or condensate that corresponds to a classical solution has a classical analog?
Well, sure, but I mean the question is whether that limit really corresponds to a classical limit in which what you obtain at the end describes something like continuum geometry or continuum GR. Right? So if you I think, for example, the WKD limit, if you think about it for the real condensate, is something very strange. It would basically mean that you have a condensate that is completely homogeneous, that has kind of constant density, but very high velocity, right? Because the WKB is a rapidly oscillating phase, so that's very high velocity. So that's very unclear what regime you are describing there, at least for me.
Let me put the question differently. Yep. Is the situation analogous or different than the standard relation between coherent state, or as you say, condensate, in free Maxwell theory and classical electromagnetic field? Is it the same story or is it a different story?
I think it's a different story.
Maxwell theory is a linear
theory. Yeah.
And where does the difference come in? Why there is a difference?
I mean, one difference is that free Maxwell theory is a linear theory. There's no interaction between photons. So this
there's
is closer.
There's no interaction between those individual quanta here either.
No, that's not true. I mean, we get there is an interaction term in the GFT. This is really closer to an atomic system. Then, as an approximation, of course, you can decide to. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I thought that your example in slide 19 was without an interaction term, just to clarify.
No, but let's clear up the misunderstanding. So, you have an interacting field theory for your atoms in quotes. Then indeed you can look for approximations of the equations where you neglect or you consider subdominant particular interaction terms. We can indeed argue whether that is, the right approximation and so on, but the system is an interacting field theory. And so the difference with the photons is that, free Maxwell theory is simply non-interacting field theory for the photons. That's the only thing I was saying.
No, but I think I agree with Carlos that you are, in this approximation that you already, so let's just talk about the approximation in which this equation is arising, equation on slide 19. In that approximation, there are no interactions between various quanta. So Carlos' question is, in this approximation, should he think of the coherent states as one thinks in Maxwell theory or not? That is his question.
Are you talking about the formal treatment or the physical treatment? Because the formal treatment, yes, indeed.
Slide 19.
No, I understand, but what I mean is that technically, indeed, is you treat it the same way. Whether, the type of semi-classical physics in space-time terms has to be extracted the way you extract classical physics from quantum Maxwell theory, that's a different question. And I think what Stefan was saying, and I would agree, is that we don't really know if the standard classical limit, which is just L, which here would be just L plan going to zero, is the correct way of extracting semi-classical space-time physics from the system. Formally, is indeed if you stick to a free theory, then you go ahead the same way. It's the physics which is different. Well, which is probably different.
Carlo, do you want to follow up, or are you at this stage?
Well,
okay.
I'm confused, but I have another question. In this simple case, if I understood correctly, you make a choice about the dependence of N on A, and somehow mimicking what happened in loop quantum cosmology. But in loop quantum cosmology, the philosophy was very different. It's a quantization of, at least at the beginning, it's a quantization of a model, and then one has to bring in some information from the full theory, and one has a way of bringing in the information from the... So an extra input at that point. Extra input is exactly what one needs somehow.
Yeah.